Thank you very much. I want to thank the RZC for bringing me in, and particularly to Rabbi Eisenberg. I got an email from him before this event, which was probably the most organized pre-event email I've received in my rabbinic career, so that was quite impressive. And he manages to combine that with being flexible enough that if I sent a source sheet in on Friday afternoon, he was okay with that also. So that's a nice combination. So I'm going to give out the source sheet. Please don't be intimidated that I did not translate things into English over here. I guess it's particularly appropriate because we're thinking about the state of Israel. And I think one great story that we don't talk about as much, obviously we talk a lot about the amazing thing of a people returning to their homeland after a 1900-year hiatus, but the truth is the revival of the Hebrew language is also a remarkable story that perhaps does not get spoken about as much. Just to give you an example, put it in context, imagine if contemporary Egyptians said, oh, we're going to revive Coptic. It's true, no one's spoken Coptic for centuries, but we could just start right now. Okay, no one would have such a thought that you could do such a thing. And one of the reasons why we were able to do it, people have pointed out that it's not really true that Hebrew was a dead language for 1900 years. Hebrew did remain alive. I can see Rabbi Eisenberg smiling. He likes languages. Okay, Hebrew did remain alive. In the world of Tefillah, Hebrew remained alive. And in the world of Talmud Torah. It's kind of interesting if we think about it, almost all famous Torah works for the last 1900 years were written in Hebrew. Right? One can think of isolated exceptions, like what the Rambam wrote the Mor Nevuchim in Arabic. And the Rav Hirsch wrote his commentary on Chumash in German. But for the most part, their language of Torah remained a Hebrew language. And that's why it wasn't really fully dead when we revived. It's still an amazing accomplishment. But we had something to work off. Yeah, please.
20% of Yiddish is Hebrew.
Okay, there you go. Okay, we have another linguist here. I got to find out before that she speaks both Hebrew, Yiddish, and Polish, actually. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's correct. Yiddish helped also, the fact that Hebrew is so much a part of things. So be that as it may, the source sheet will be in Hebrew today. And I'll translate everything, so do not be nervous. Okay, let's just do two pieces of background before we start. One is there's a term that gets tossed around a bit in yeshiva circles called Torat Eretz Yisrael, the Torah of Israel. Some of you might be familiar, there's a yeshiva hesder in Maalot in the north, which talks about this as their banner. We teach Torat Eretz Yisrael. And it's not obvious what Torat Eretz Yisrael means. I'm not sure everybody necessarily uses it the same way. But we're going to try to explore what Torah Eretz Israel might mean. And how would the Torah in the land of Israel differ from the Torah in the diaspora? Okay, so that's one question. Beyond that, I want to introduce two of the people we're talking about here, who I think really are Rabbanim, who are very much associated with love of the land of Israel. So the most famous yeshiva in Europe, of course, was a yeshiva called Volozhin. Okay, the Rosh Yeshiva for many years was a man named Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv. In fact, he had two sons who did interesting things. One son named Chaim was a Rav, and therefore there's a yeshiva called Chaim Berlin. That's a son of the Netziv. His other son moved to Israel and Hebraicized his name. Okay, from Berlin to Bar Ilan. That was Meir Bar Ilan. He was a major religious Zionist. And that's also why we have Bar Ilan University. So Netziv has a pretty interesting lineage. Leads to Yeshivat Chaim Berlin and to Bar Ilan University. And Netziv was a supporter of Chibat Zion. He was a supporter of settling the land of Israel in the 1800s. The Rosh Yeshiva Volozhin. Now let's move from the Netziv to a student of his. So Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook learned in the Volozhin Yeshiva. And he actually was quite affected by the Netziv. He has an essay honoring the Netziv. And Rav Cook, of course, is the Rav who is most associated with supporting the Zionist enterprise. Okay, obviously, when Zionism started, it was predominantly a secular movement, and therefore, most of the Orthodox rabbinate was not enthusiastic about it. But the Rav Cook was able to see that the goodness in this endeavor, and he supported it. And of course, he moved to Israel in 1905 and became a very significant Rav in the history of religious Zionism. In fact, many of you may know that it's always this humorous thing when you talk about who the Rav is. So if you're in an American community, say the Rav, they tend to refer to Rav Soloveitchik. But if you're in an Israeli yeshiva and they say there's a shiur b'machshevet harav, right, it is not Rav Soloveitchik, it is Rav Cook. Okay, so these are the major rabbinic forces in the world of religious Zionism. Okay, so that's the background, and now let us get to the topic today. Okay, so we are starting with the Gemara in Sanhedrin. And we're going to see how these two great rabbinic figures might play off this Gemara. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, it's quoting a pasuk in the third parak of Eicha, B'mechashakim hoshivani kimetei olam. Mechashakim is from the word choshech. You somehow settled me, you had me dwell in darkness like the dead of old, or the dead of eternity. Amr of Yirmiyahu, what's this about, this darkness that I'm settled in? Zeh Talmuda shel Bavel. This is the Babylonian Talmud. Now, I think most of us would agree that darkness is probably a negative imagery. Okay, it's usually not a positive way of thinking about things. So Rabbi Yirmiyahu seems to be critical of the Babylonian mode of Talmudic education. And indeed, there's several Gemara to kind of contrast what was going on in the yeshivot in Israel, what was going on in the yeshivot in Bavel. Because if we're in the Amoraic period, there are really two centers of Jewish learning. Right? What's going on in Palestine, what's going on in Bavel. So he says this is darkness. And Rashi indeed seems to take it in a negative fashion. If we go to the second source, it says Rashi, She'ein nochin ze'emzeh. They're not so pleasant. It seems to have been a more argumentative culture there in Bavel. Okay, I guess maybe things have shifted a bit over the years. V'tamudam safek biyadam. And therefore, there's something doubtful about their learning. It's hard to come to a concrete conclusion. There's something darker about it. So Rashi certainly is taking it in a more negative fashion. And I will point out, if again, most of us who learn Gemara, we learn a lot of Bavli. We don't learn very much Yerushalmi. But the Yerushalmi seems to be a bit more straightforward than the Bavli. The Bavli has a much more complex argumentation, which again, could be a positive, could be a negative, but maybe there's a certain lack of clarity. There's something more direct about the Yerushalmi. I'm just going to mention one example. It's a little bit unfair, because one example really doesn't prove anything, but maybe just to get a little bit of a sense of it. So those of you who've learned Psachim, this is not in your sheet, may know there's a discussion of Bedikar Chametz in the very beginning of Psachim. And discussion, one of the questions there is, why do we use a candle? So the Bavli has this very complex drasha, linking all kinds of words. Okay, what's the complex drasha? Well, the word matzah appears in a chametz context, right? Lo yimatzeh, don't find chametz. There's a pasuk in Tanakh which connects the word matzah to the word chipus, searching. So we have matzah equals chipus. And then you have a third pasuk where the word chipus is connected to ner. So the Bavli says, matzah links with chipus, links with ner. That's why we use a candle for Bedikar Chametz. Okay, if you look at the Yerushalmi, okay, I'll read the Yerushalmi, I think you'll find it quite interesting. The Yerushalmi says, Lama l'or haner, why do we use a candle? Amar Rav Shmuel bar Rav Yitzchak, mifnei shehaner bodek kol shehu. Because a candle is great for checking in those cracks and crevices. Right? We don't need a fancy drush of matzah, chipus, ner. Very practically, a candle is just an efficient method of doing Bedikar Chametz. So as I said, one example hardly proves everything. But there is a certain straightforwardness there to the Yerushalmi where the Bavli is in a more intricate, complex method of trying to get to the conclusion. Okay? Great. So at this point, it sounds like there's kind of a criticism of the Bavli. However, the Netziv does something really fascinating. Let us look at the third source. Okay, this is the Netziv's famous commentary on Chumash, the Hamek Davar. And he quotes a really amazing debate. In fact, I never would have thought of asking the question. But sometimes you wouldn't have thought of asking it. Once someone asks it, it leads in an interesting direction. The Ibn Ezra wants to know which set of luchot was holier. The first set that Moshe broke, or the second set? Now, I have to admit, when I read Chumash, it never occurred to me to ask that question. Like, there's something about like holiness comparison between the first set and the second set. Okay, if already someone's going to ask the question, anyone have a gut reaction? What would you go with? Which set would be holier? Yeah, what do you think?
Well, God made the first set.
Excellent. Good, we have a knowledgeable crowd here. Okay, what is Moshe? Well, I'll continue 1 second. What is Moshe told in for the second set? Psalacha. You engrave it. So surely, what's your name?
Yaakov.
Okay, so Yaakov says, surely, and Ebenezer's on your team, surely the first set is holier, right? The first set is engraved by God. Second set, it's engraved by humanity. Surely God is holier than humanity. Yeah, what did you want to suggest?
I'm just going to guess the second.
Okay. Why?
No, take too long. I'll let you explain.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Now you got me curious what your explanation is. Yeah.
I would say you can say the second because it's still here.
Okay. So you could say the first one broke at the end of the day and the second one is still present. Okay. Excellent. Anybody else? Yeah, please.
The second set gave us the Torah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, in the back.
The second set we actually lived out. And by living through the second set, we're able to.
Okay, very interesting, very interesting. Okay, great. Great suggestions. So let's look inside for how this plays out. Okay, so now we're in source 3. Okay, if you don't have a sheet, you can just listen, I'll summarize it. Yesh lakdim ashakata rav avim ben ezra b'shim gonzel. What did there Ben Ezra? Ibn Ezra quotes the Gon. Usually the anonymous Gon is Rav Sadia Gon. De luchot shniot mechubadim min arishonim. So Rav Saadia Gaon sides with the latter position in this room, that the second set of luchot were somehow more honorable than the first. V'Rav Avni ben Ezra katav al zeh, what did the Ibn Ezra write? Eile divrei chalom. Now that's not a compliment. Okay, these are the words of a dream. Lo malin v'lo moridin. Now what's the Ibn Ezra thinking? Exactly what Yaakov said. The Ibn Ezra's thinking, that makes no sense. Surely God's handiwork is going to outdo human efforts. And therefore you got to go with the first set of luchot. But the Netziv would like to defend the Gaon. So he says, El divrei Gaon lav divrei reikim. Okay, they're not empty. There's something to what the Gaon said. Let's see what his argument's going to be. The kavanah b'kol zeh, the beluchot arishonot lo nitan koach hachidush. So I'm not going to do the whole thing inside. He would like to argue that the second luchot wasn't just a different physical set of tablets, but was a different approach to Torah. It was a more creative approach, right? That somehow in the first luchot was mostly just tradition. We know what we got from God, but you didn't have all the human ingenuity involved in the larger Torah Sheval Peh endeavor. And the Netziv would say that's part of the shift from the first luchot to the second luchot, that it's now we'd only receive Torah in a traditional fashion, but we use the structure we've been given, the 13 modes of interpretation, to generate new understanding and new psak. Now, if we think about it for a second, this fits very nicely symbolically. Where would the Netziv see this symbolically, that the second luchot had this broader human element? Well, that's the fact that, as we said before, Moshe engraves it. Right, for the Netziv, it's not just like a shift in construction tactics, it's reflective of a shift in Torah. That now Torah is going to have a greater human capacity. Now why is this true? Why does that happen between the first Luchot and the second Luchot? So let's skip down a little bit. We are now in, 2, 3, 4, 5, the eighth line, towards the end of the line, where it says, Kol zeh hayah ha'egel. Says the Netziv, V'kol zeh ha'egel siba lazeh. The egel was the cause of this. Shenigza yom paktu fakarati, right? Because obviously the egel is what causes the breaking of the first luchot. Umishum hachi higia begzer maglim galut upizur baratzot. So what does the egel stand for in this conception? Am Yisrael is going to sin, and unfortunately, exile is going to be part of the program. It's not going to be that we remain in the land of Israel forever. There are going to be problems, and the egel is representative of that. And therefore, what? Ah, v'hi siba machrechet lepipula shel Torah mitzad shnei tamim, haynu mitzad shmira ta'uma. Apparently this more complex Torah, this more human Torah, is the one that's needed to survive in the Galut. And so basically for the Netziv, the way this structure works is, Cheda Egel, the sin of the golden calf, generates exile. Exile generates the need for this broader conception of Torah, this with greater human ingenuity. And I think if we think about it, really Talmud Torah is a big part of what kept us going through all those years of exile. Right? Certainly when you don't have a homeland, when you don't have a mikdash, right, Talmud Torah becomes more, it's always central, becomes even more central to the Jewish religious experience. Right? There are almost these competing institutions, not competing, these complementary institutions, right, without a state, without sovereignty. And Talmud Torah really keeps us going. So there was this need in the Galut for this more human component to Talmud Torah, and that's what happened after the first Luchot and the move to the second Luchot. Okay, now what does it do with our topic? So let's now go to the last section after an ellipsis. You see there's like five dots, and this is V'kol zeh. So the Netziv says, now remember, what was the debate? Ibn Ezra says, obviously the first Luchot are holier. And the Netziv is trying to defend the Gaon, that there was something better about the second set. Okay, here we go. The kol zeh divrei Gaon, the bezeh prat, in this detail, hayeluchot shniot mechubadim in rishonot, da'avgav shekdushat harishon matin el amem. I see, something really beautiful. I think sometimes in life, we're not nuanced enough. So maybe the whole question we weren't nuanced enough is, there's better and there's worse, there's higher and there's lower. But what are going to be, there are different ways of evaluating something. And notice how he uses his terminology very carefully. What is more kadosh and what is more mechubad? Okay, what is holier and what is more honorable, as it were? What does he claim is holier?
The first.
But that makes sense. What is something we associate holiness with? Holiness is a divine category. So the more godly involvement, the more holiness. So there, as far as kedusha, is of course the first one is more kadosh. But what if you're asking not a more kadosh question? You're asking what's more significant in a given context? What's going to lead to your survival, to your flourishing? Maybe that's a mechubad question. And from that perspective, one can say the first luchot are more kadosh, the second one are more mechubad, And then he goes on to say, and this really gets to our topic, he says, that's the difference. Maybe I'll do the rest outside, just to make sure we run out of time. Since we have two excellent speakers coming, I don't want to steal their time, especially because one is my dear colleague. So the Netziv goes on to say, that's also the difference between the Yushalmi and the Bavli. Now remember we pointed out before that the Yushalmi is a bit more straightforward in its reasoning? So that would fit also, right? The Bavli represents kind of the second Luchot, right? This expansion of human creativity in Torah and for the Galut. And the Yushalmi would be this more straightforward kind of Torah, more reminiscent of the first set of Luchot. And he says the same thing. He says, what's more Kadosh? The Yushalmi is more Kadosh. Because just like we associate sanctity with God, we associate sanctity with the land of Israel. So the Yushalmi would be more kadosh than the Bavli. But in a given scenario, maybe we need the Bavli. So the Bavli could be more mechubad than the Yushalmi. Okay, last part of Netziv, then we'll get to Rav Kook. The Netziv says something else I think is very nice. I like to be an optimistic thinker. Okay, I know Rabini also is quite an optimistic fellow. Even though I don't know Dr. Hachazer as well, I assume he's also a big optimist. So the Netziv has a very positive reading of the Gemara in Sanhedrin. What did the Gemara in Sanhedrin say? Bavli is dwelling in the darkness. But now we can give a positive reading of that. What's the positive reading of that? Well, a classic metaphor is that the galut is being in the darkness. So what does it mean the Bavli is something that happens in Choshech? It is what gets you through the period of Choshech. It's what enables you to thrive despite the darkness. So now, let's just sum up the Netziv and move on to Rav Kook. In a certain sense, the Netziv has given us a very balanced approach, which really doesn't provide like a favoritism. It's not so much like anti the Bavli. It's that each one has its place, right? The Yushalmi, the Torah Eretz Yisrael, has its more simple kadosh aspect, where the Torah Bavel is a more complex but a more mechubad aspect and is necessary in a given scenario. And therefore, don't read, even though I think it's not the simple pshat, don't read the Gemara in Sanhedrin as, oh, it's dark in the Bavli, because the Bavli is what gets you through the darkness. Okay? Terrific. Let us now move on to the Netziv student, to Rav Kook. Okay, now, given the time constraints, I'm not going to read all the aspects here. Let's start with the two most important ones, what I think is the two most important, and then we will move on to, if we have time, we'll do some more. Okay, let us go to, if you turn the page, please, as to where this is coming from. Rav Kook has a beautiful sefer, he has many beautiful sefarim, very prolific writer, called Orot HaTorah. Okay, and Orot HaTorah, one of these sections is about Torah Eretz Yisrael and Torah Chutz Lartz. So those who are curious about this topic, that would be really a place to go. I'm actually not 100% sure if anybody has yet translated Orot HaTorah into English, but there are some very nice Rav Kook translations out there. I'm just not sure if this has been translated yet. I'm actually pretty sure it has not been. Okay, but that's a good project, Rabbi Eisenberg. That could be your next translation project. Okay, so let's go to Gimel and Dalet. I think Rav Kook says two very powerful things here, a sense of what Torah Eretz Yisrael might be. Kol mashu shagur biyachas shel Torah Chutz Lartz b'muvan prati. Everything that we're talking about in terms of the Torah Chutz Lartz b'muvan prati. In what vein is it happening? Prat, on an individual level, on a detail level. Olehu be'erech Torah Eretz Yisrael b'muvan klali. There's some shift from the individual, the detail, to some kind of broader unit. There's a shift from the prat to the klal in the move from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. Torah Chutz Lartz oseket b'tikun ha-nefesh ha-pratit. Okay, the Torah of Chutz Lartz is worried about how to help the soul of the individual person. B'dagata l'chumiyata v'chniyata. With concern for its material condition and its spiritual condition. L'zikucha and its purification. V'talota b'chayesha v'cha'olam. Avol rak b'tor nefesh pratit. But only qua the individual soul. Lo kein Torah Eretz Yisrael. This is not about the Torah of Israel. He doeget tamid bar haklal. It is to think on a general level. Bar klalut nishmat ha'uma kula. Now I think if we think about it, I'm going to try to argue that both of my two major themes in Rav Kook really have been manifest today. Okay, what's one of the aspects we find in Return to Israel? I think we have to ask Torah questions that we haven't asked for centuries. Okay, and many of those have to do with a collective level, right? I'll give you three categories. Let us say we have to ask economic questions. Like what is the balance between, I don't know, capitalism and socialism and a Torah economy, right? You don't have to ask that if you're in Spain in 1327, right? Nobody's asking that question. But now we have a state of Israel. So, okay, what's our position on socialized medicine? What's our position on a host of economic issues? And you're forced to have that, ask that question when you have a country. Military issues is a great example, right? The state of Israel has brought all kinds of military questions into play, right? Is the draft obligatory? What's the status of enemy civilians in wartime, right? Nobody asked that question, you know, in Shtetl in Poland in 1687, right? That was not a question that needed to be asked. But now we're asking those very important questions. Jewish criminal law, like halacha doesn't really have such a concept of jail. What should jail look like in the contemporary Jewish state? So these are very important questions. No question the answers are not easy. And I would say to a great degree, to post-game or to some degree, playing catch-up, as it were. Because one of the ways halacha usually works is that it develops naturally over centuries and questions come up and we respond to them. But when you haven't asked questions for, you know, 1,500 years, 1,900 years, there's a lot of catch-up to play. But we're doing the best we can. And I think, again, it shows one of the beautiful benefits of the state of Israel, right? Torah values are not only going to be applied to individual questions, what's happening in my shul, what's happening on my block, right? We have to figure out how to apply the ideals of Torah on a much more general level, on politics, sociology, economy, and the like. And that, I think, is a very powerful idea. Okay, so one idea in Torah Yisrael would be the shift from asking questions on an individual level to asking questions on a communal level, which I think really has been manifest. Let's give you like one last example. Okay, those of you who like practical halacha, so there's a journal that Mechon Tzomet puts out called Tchumen. If you just glance through the series of topics in Tchumen, you really see this. Right here, we are trying to figure out how to apply halacha to the contemporary situation on all levels of human society. Okay. Let us go to Dalit. Okay, in Dalit, Rav Kook is going to mention another new aspect of what Torah Eretz Yisrael is meant to be. And I think here we will see that this is also manifest in contemporary Israel. Here we go. Lo rak ha'agada levada tu'ar mi'orion ha'behir shel Torah Eretz Yisrael. It's not just the agada. Okay, as I mentioned before, my one book is on Agadah. So this is a topic close to my heart. Agadah, of course, is the non-legal sections of the Talmud. So he says it's not just the Agadah will be illuminated by Israel. By the way, notice already there seems to be some association of Cook's mind between Torah Eretz Yisrael and the world of Agadah, the non-legal portions of the Gemara. Let's keep going. Ki im gam halacha. So it's also going to illuminate the legal portions as well. Yisodot ha-svarot nituach ha-psakim. Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit quickly for a second. Sharshei hashitot umuvnan hakolli anuutz bomkei chayim uchanim asayim v'lo rak haTorah b'muvnan limudim matzui b'damot shalacha. And not only just Torah. He already expanded, it'll be halacha and agadah, but even beyond the Beit Midrash, kim ha'arat hachayim kulam. There's something about Torah Yisrael that'll extend to life in general. Let's see what this is. Okay, hakol taloi ba'osher rayon me'omek hatchia ruchanit hamuchen haTorah Yisrael. Okay, here's the line I really wanted: hagvulim v'kirot habarzel shebein inyan linyan. These iron walls between topics, because if you ben miktsoa lemiktsoa, between different fields of study, yelchuv yikatnu, they'll get smaller. Now this is also fascinating. Okay, in the world of learning, thank God, one of the great things about Torah is there's so many different aspects to it. And I always tell my students, everybody can find the aspect that really speaks to them. There'll be people here who love Tanakh, people who love practical halacha, people love theoretical Gemara, people love Jewish philosophy, Machshava. There are all kinds of aspects to Torah, but even within all those aspects, there's again a second question, which is, do I view them as kind of disparate studies? Each one has their own building, as it were. So I'm in Tanakh mode, then I shut down Tanakh mode, I go to Gemara mode, I move my Gemara mode away, and I go to Machshava mode. Or is there some kind of integration between them? Right, to switch imageries, they're not separate houses, they're one mansion, they're different rooms in the mansion. And I can like look from one room into the other room. They're not totally disparate entities. So in Rav Kook's mind, this is also, I think, a very interesting point. Rav Kook thinks that that's one of the differences. Somehow, Israel's about putting things together. So in Bavel, we do study all these things in Chutz La'aretz, but it's less of an integrationist approach. I'm either wearing my Gemara t-shirt or I'm wearing my Tanakh t-shirt. And here, when I come to Eretz Yisrael, I'm able somehow to integrate them all and put them together. And I think if we think about it, it's really quite fascinating because I would suggest this is also happening. Okay, let's think about some things. Again, I'm not sure how familiar you are with what goes on in Israel, but some things that happened in the last 70 years in the land of Israel. So one thing I would say, there's been a bit of a Tanakh revolution. Okay, in yeshiva, traditionally, right, learning was very much associated with the world of Gemara and Halakha. And there have been several figures in Israel who really put Tanakh on the map, as it were. Okay, just to mention some of them, right? Obviously, Nechama Leibowitz would be a good place to start. Okay, then more contemporary people, you may have heard of Rav Yoel ben Nun and Rav Samet, right? Even younger people, Professor Yoni Grossman, right? There are many people in Tanakh study where in the land of Israel, where Tanakh is much more part of the Talmud Torah curriculum in a very profound way. And I think we can explain that in various ways. Obviously, being in the land of Israel in some ways connects you to Tanakh very deeply because you have sovereignty, and you're connecting to a time when Jews had sovereignty, which is not the Talmud Bavli, right? And it's taking place in the right location, right? This is taking place in the land of Israel. So it's not an accident. Many of you have probably been on Teulim like that, right? You know, the Tanakh in hand Teulim, right? This is where David fought Goliath on this hill here. Excuse me. So it's natural. Okay, someone just give me a couple of please. It is natural that... thank you. It is natural that coming to Israel will create a interest, thanks very much, and revolution in Tanakh study, and indeed it's done so. It has really done so. Thanks so much. So that fits with Rav Kook. But I would say Agadah as well. Okay, there are more books, I think, written about the Agadic parts of the Gemara in the last 20 years that were done beforehand. And I think also you see this in Israeli yeshivot, in Yeshivot Hasder and Mechinot, that there's a more of a place for Tanakh study and more of a place for study of the Agadah and non-legal portions of Gemara. And even further, remember Rav Kook said it was also about a Torah Chaim, a Torah of life? So let's just look at one more line here and wrap it up. Okay, if we go down a little bit to, you see the line that begins with the Hodah Chaim? I'm really just skipping one line. Hodah Chaim lechem dar harazim. Okay, here we go. Let's see what Rav Kook lists here as what's going to be in the Torah Eretz Yisrael. Biur halachot, so you have halacha. V'hitrachvut hachazayon v'hashira. Right, shira, like poetry. Right, that's also going to be, Rav Kook was a poet also. So we're going to have this expansion of the Torah curriculum. Chafetz hashkeda mitzuyanet. Now look what else comes in here. V'cheshech hahitpatchut hagufanit. So we really have a broader curriculum. Apparently, like even phys ed is part of the curriculum. Okay, we're going to develop physically, which is something Rav Kook got criticized for talking about even physicality and exercise as part of religious vision. But why not? If you're going to have a country, you're going to have an army, surely physical education is going to be crucial. So Rav Kook would say, I think this also fits. When you live in, there's something more constricted, more narrow about a Torah of Chutz La'aretz. And when you have a country, by definition, it's going to lead to an expansive mode. And notice we've had here, I think we've had two themes of the expansive mode. Okay, theme one was that you have to apply halakha to a klali level, to a national level, which we talked about on a political level, on an economic level, etc. And perhaps the other expansion is the nature of the Torah curriculum. What should a yeshiva or a seminary curriculum look like? Says Rav Kook, in Eretz Yisrael, it's going to be more integrationist, right? It's going to involve Tanakh, it's going to involve Agadah, it's going to even involve physical education, as it were. And indeed, I think both these themes have been very manifest in contemporary education in the land of Israel. So I will close by saying as follows. Like, on the one hand, I think we could be appreciative of the Netziv. In the Netziv's mind, it's not so much a better or worse. It is that different eras have different necessities. And in the Galut, there was a real necessity for the Talmud Bavli kind of approach, this more complex kind of argumentation. Okay, at the same time, Rav Kook would say, and I think Rav Kook would agree with that, could say there's certain unique things to the Torah Eretz Yisrael that we could feel very proud of and very joyous that we have this opportunity. It's not that we're going to throw out the Bavli, of course. We'll retain that kind of reasoning. But we will now also be able to add these elements, to add these elements of thinking about things on a Klali level, on a national level, and also about integrating all the different rooms of the grand mansion of Torah. So I'll just close with one thing. You know, please God, people in the room should merit to come to the land of Israel. But even if you don't, like maybe one of the great things about the Torah Eretz Yisrael is maybe it doesn't only have to happen in the land of Israel. That once, thank God, we have a state again, so these kind of values and ideas could then trickle out to the other communities of the Gola as well. So hopefully, it seems like a wonderful room of people here. You can all be involved in the endeavor of Talmud Torah. And hopefully a little of the Torah Eretz Yisrael will make its way to, you know, Dempster also, okay, which will include a thinking of ideals on a national level. And it will also include all the wonderful aspects of Torah, be they Gemara, be they Halakha, be they Tanakh, be they Machshava, all integrated into the search to become more refined human beings.
Yeah.